thank you. So as Crystal just mentioned, Corey and I are both parents, and we love our kids so much. And we're also really excited to be here with all of you to talk about why we need to abolish the family. We don't claim our expertise from academia, but we are activists, and we see our liberation is bound up with other liberation struggles. We think social reproduction theory provides a perspective that knits together lots of aspects of different gender-based oppressions. Traditionally, Marxists have talked about the family as the root of women's oppression, meaning the basis of cis women's oppression in class societies. And we want to build on that framework to talk about how and why class societies produce gender overall, and how those oppressions provide a really important foundation for capitalist exploitation. Social reproduction theory helps us understand how capitalism works, which means that it's clarifying of pretty much everything. And we're gonna really try not to talk about everything. But we do wanna try to look at, what does the world look like if you say that social reproduction is really central to capitalism and to struggles that challenge capitalism? So first of all, what do we mean by social reproduction? Social reproduction means the replication of the defining social relations of capitalism. So the maintenance of the class of people who own all the wealth and wield all the power in society, and then the maintenance of the much larger class of people who have to sell our creative and productive capacities for survival. It entails the production and maintenance of labor power, the generational replacement of workers, care for young, old, impaired, or unlucky people who are unable to sell their labor power, and the public institutions and infrastructure that make productive labor possible. I'm going to run through a little bit of kind of introductory Marxist economics. Could I get a quick show of hands of how many people feel like they've been introduced to some of those ideas? Okay, awesome. That's great. And we can help each other through the discussion too. So Marx's account of capitalist exploitation begins with the labor theory of value. The only way that profit can be created is the exploitation of labor power. Exploitation for Marx specifically means underpayment. We're supposed to get a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, but in reality, the only way that our bosses make any money is by paying us less than the actual value of the work that we do. That's why Marx's famous formulation is that capitalism creates its own grave diggers, right? It relies on the labor power of people who are underpaid for their work. What a wage really does is it covers the cost of continuing to bring ourselves to work from one day to the next. But the work that we do creates commodities, goods or services produced for sale, that our bosses can then sell for more than the amount they pay out in wages, supplies, and infrastructure. And that's where all of the wealth in capitalist society comes from. Marx called the part of the work that we do that covers what we're paid back in wages necessary labor, and the part of our work that our bosses steal as surplus labor. And surplus labor creates surplus value, aka profit, which the capitalist is then free to keep or reinvest as they see fit. Now, labor power is a unique commodity in capitalism. It's the only thing that creates surplus value. So what makes it so magical? One way is that when we bring our wages home, we add more labor to it that stretches our wages into a living. We buy groceries that we cook, we pay rent or mortgages on homes that we clean. Marx's labor theory of value identifies that the prices of all commodities are determined by the socially necessary labor time needed to produce them. The market supply and demand can explain some of how prices fluctuate around their usual cost, but it can't explain what that usual cost is. And that cost isn't determined by how useful something it is, because that could be highly relative, but it's based on how much money the capitalist had to pay for the labor that went into producing that good or service. Now, Tithi Bhattacharya writes in her essay, How Not to Skip Class, which is her contribution to a really excellent volume of essays called Social Reproduction Theory, that Marx actually didn't fully explain what sets the price of labor power itself. Aside from the work that we do to stretch our wages into a living, the other source of labor's magic power to create surplus value is our ability to adjust our lives to dealing with less, right? Our ability to yeah, to survive, basically to prevent human suffering that allows for the capitalist class to drive wages down. And that actually requires for capitalism reorganizing our conditions of life in a way that makes us accept that we have to do with less. And capitalism is built on a really contradictory relationship with the maintenance of labor power. Capitalists need our labor, but they also are constantly driven to upset the social bases for our social reproduction. And we want to argue that that antagonism is just as central to understanding what happens with capitalism and understanding capitalist crisis as Marx's formulation about capitalism creating its own grave diggers in the working class. So one side of this dynamic is that capitalists always want to drive down the price of labor power so that they can compete with one another. If the cost of labor power is driven down to its lowest extreme, workers can subsist on rotten food and live in barracks, see Foxconn, and their bosses can pay very little for their labor power while selling the resulting iPhones at a substantial profit. But this drive to lower labor costs comes with a whole bunch of problems, not just for us, but also for the capitalists. One problem is that they need to be able to sell their commodities, usually to other workers who have to be able to afford them. In more economically developed places, neoliberal capitalism has been using the threat of flight to cheaper labor zones as a battering ram against wages and living conditions of the highest paid workers too. So that's a problem. And also this international inequality compels workers to flee less economically developed areas for more economically developed ones. A total of 70.8 million people are currently forcibly displaced around the globe. That's the highest number in human history. Workers in wealthier nations are also struggling to get by, and specifically to provide for their families is one of the key ways that we're motivated to participate in this system. And that anxiety is then set upon by right-wing efforts to turn our resentment against those struggling even more than we are. And that's why we see nationalism rising across the more economically developed parts of the world. Meanwhile, immigrants who do manage to get to the global north most often find opportunities to sell their labor power, fulfilling socially reproductive tasks like cooking, cleaning, caring for children, providing home health care. Some of the least rewarded and most needed jobs that simultaneously denigrate and erase the value of the people who do them, whether for free in our own homes or deeply underpaid in workplaces. Now, another problem for capitalists with reducing the price of labor power is that if you work people to death, they have to be replaced. In her path-breaking 1983 book, Marxism and the Oppression of Women, Lise Vogel notes that while capitalist societies can organize social reproduction in a variety of ways, the preferred system tends to revolve around a nuclear family that takes on the private responsibility for the maintenance of existing workers and rearing new generations. She fills in a famously missing gap in the work of Frederick Engels, who wrote The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. In The Origin, Engels describes how human society's kinship groups changed over time based on the way that they produced the goods needed for their survival. So under hunter-gatherer societies, people lived in small groups that were pretty egalitarian, where people had to kind of provide for one another in order to mutually survive. But as people settled and developed agriculture, developed a surplus, men subjugated women on one hand by repressing them into one-sided monogamous marriages so that their husbands could be certain that their wealth was being passed down to just their heirs, and on the other hand by sexually exploiting women who had no property and no other means of survival except to sell excess to their bodies. Engels never theorized how the nuclear family came to predominate among working class people, among people who have no property to hand down, and that's where Lise Vogel's book is so important and useful. We've talked already about how working class families assume private responsibility for all the work that stretches our wages, but workers who are only paid just enough to get by have to have a plan for when one worker needs some time off to give birth, recover from labor, and then care for a very dependent newborn. And Vogel really stresses that as one of the main reasons that the nuclear family is so useful to capitalist societies. Vogel argues that, so she also makes the point that the nuclear family is really useful because it sets up a relationship between men and women that provides an enormous amount of political stability for capitalist life. So men can be motivated to work in order to provide for a wife or partner and family. Women are supposed to be motivated primarily in our lives by attracting the attention of cisgender men, so that ultimately we can get them to cover our costs while we fulfill our biological destiny of having children. Now, Marxists have built on this dynamic to explain the roots of much of cisgender women's degraded place in society, where working class men are able to measure their value in a capitalist society by the amount of their wages. Women's value is really dragged down by the heaps of unpaid labor that we tend to do the lion's share of at home. Of course, the flip side of that is that that working people also take out their displaced resentments on the people closest to them. So the frustrated hope of attaining honor or status through one's spouse or kids can explode into violence, especially carried out by cisgender men who are trapped between ideologies of entitlement over women's bodies and lives, and also the very real limits of their self-actualization under capitalism. So on one hand, this can be, the family can be, the source of the meaning and sweetness in our lives. It can also be the source of really violent contention. This is carried out, not as a conspiracy. I think it would be helpful to talk some about how ideology works in societies. It's not a series of ideas that are just stamped on people's brains by a bunch of wealthy people who dream them up. It appears to make a rough sense of the actual conditions that we live in, and the nuclear family under capitalism really relies on an ideology of a gender binary, which is, I want to argue, a social construction. What I mean by a social construction is that there's lots of different categories that we take for granted as like natural, real categories of human beings that are in fact agreements made on a scale beyond individual control or decision. They tend to justify themselves by claiming to be natural and eternal. And they're agreements that could have been settled in another way. So you look at different periods of time or different cultures globally, and people actually have different understandings of race, of gender, et cetera. Because class societies are inherently antagonistic, these agreements aren't things that we all enter into equally. They're usually the product of oppression. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how this has developed in the United States. I'm sure people will be able to bring a lot into the discussion on these topics as well. But this country obviously was founded on colonization, where European Christian missionaries were horrified by what they encountered among many North American indigenous tribes, where there were more than two genders. There were two people and other conceptions of gender. And people also organized childbearing in more collective ways. And colonization really made a very explicit project of undermining that. So after the genocidal removal of natives to reservations, there was the 1887 Dawes Act, which imposed hereditary division of land on the remaining reservations in exchange for U.S. citizenship. And the law's explicit goal was to undo collective land ownership and break up tribes and force assimilation. The federal government followed that up with kidnapping and imprisoning Native youth into so-called schools, where kids who were deemed to be boys were trained in things like mechanics, and kids who were deemed to be girls were trained in the domestic arts. And this has been a very effective way of destabilizing Native communities, and I think we see the cost especially borne by Native women who survive or don't survive tremendous amounts of violence. Because social reproduction is so foundational to capitalism, other social relations like racialization are often mediated through our gender and norms and family structures. Enslaved people in this country were denied the family ties and gender roles that were really enforced for white women in the industrial era. So enslaved women were compelled to work just as hard as enslaved men. Their children could be taken from them at the slaveholder's prerogative, and that imposed failure to fulfill, gender norms that we are supposed to think of as natural, is then, ever since slavery, then pushed back on Black people and used as some of the basis for dehumanization and criminalizing people as supposedly failed parents. Likewise, right now, what we're seeing with migrant families arriving to the United States is that they're arriving here in the midst of anti-abortion legislation that's supposed to be about restoring families, protecting the rights of unborn children. And you know, we're seeing people arrive here as families, be divided up, and have their kids treated in really horrific ways. And those families are then derided by the right-wingers as supposedly not taking care well enough of their kids. So there's a Guatemalan 7-year-old named Jacqueline Amé Rosemary Calmaquin, who died in U.S. Border Patrol custody in December. She's one of dozens of people who have died in ICE or CBP custody since Trump took office. And Republicans lined up to talk about how it was her dad's fault for bringing her across the Sonoran desert that she died in custody. Likewise, many asylum seekers are fleeing Central America on the basis of domestic violence because their societies have been destabilized in really violent ways that U.S. policy has consistently supported. The Trump administration has tried to direct immigration courts not to consider domestic violence a ground for a credible fear claim and therefore asylum status. There was a legal aid worker who spoke at an International Women's Day panel that we had here in Chicago who talked about one of the women that she worked with from Honduras who had been told by the Honduran police, who are like literally the enforcers of a coup regime that the US backs, they told her, don't call us unless there's a body. And she comes here and the legal aid workers have to tell her, domestic violence is also not enough here for us to consider offering you any protection. So it's again a situation where people who are supposedly failing in their marriages or families are then being dehumanized on that basis. So the point of all this is that capitalism can organize social reproduction in lots of different ways. It can rely on slavery or immigration or imperialism to drive down the price of labor power and the living conditions that come with it. Domestically, it also relies on the nuclear family and the sexism and gender binary that come with that. Those quite different looking gender roles aren't separate phenomena. It's not an accident that these two different phenomena happen. They're used to uphold and discipline one another, right? And so that's why we say that there's no women's liberation without Native liberation, no Black liberation without trans liberation, no queer liberation without border abolition.
So I think some of the tasks ahead of us today are formidable in building a new kind of social reproduction theory that works for the moment of today. But we do stand on the shoulders of giants. So none of what we're talking about today would be possible without the work of Lise Vogel, Sylvia Federici, Angela Davis, and so forth. However, we're really excited to be in a milieu of folks who are addressing these questions in really beautiful, dynamic ways, such as Holly Lewis, Sophie Lewis, many people in this room and so forth. And I think the reason that this is happening is the beautiful explosion of gender that has been occurring before our very eyes in the new kind of trans moment over the last many years, alongside a disgusting backlash and a reassertion of the importance of the gender binary for capitalism. And I think that really demands a social reproduction theory that doesn't make questions of gender itself as an add-on, or questions about queer and trans oppression as an add-on to the oppression of cis women. However, the critical insights that our predecessors in Marxist thinking made would not, like what we're trying to do today, would not be possible without that. That is also to say that actually I'm going to quote from Holly Lewis a ton. Female assigned persons pressured into womanhood. I love the language she uses with this, so we'll kind of get at why she does this. And heteronormative arrangements still make up the majority of the world's population, and thus the material analysis of their lives is critical. So part of the reason I say that is that, you know, adding to this doesn't actually take away from the other thing. There's such a tendency to be like, oh, you know, you can't yes and. Well, we have to yes and this is, get social reproduction theory is going to help us figure out how to do that. And the reason that is that we're obviously in a moment of tremendous political crisis. It's abhorrent, the world that we're living in right now, with the border crisis, climate crisis, economic crisis, and so forth, that really demands a Marxism that's up to the par of explaining why our socialist project is key to ending oppression. And we need a Marxism that can win, you know, generations of folks that are being radicalized by this moment. And I think failure to do that, I think, will really negatively impact our ability to strategize in this moment. And that's the question that keeps coming up this weekend. Well, what do we do? What do we do? How do we build solidarity? Well, all of that has to come from politics. So our goal, our kind of social reproduction feminism, must be able to explain why the liberation of cis women is impossible without the liberation of trans women. Must assert that reproductive justice for anyone is impossible without a truly affirmative, trans-affirming and celebratory feminism. And that's not just because, oh, trans people get pregnant too, which is true. It's not because, oh, not all women can get pregnant, which is also true. It's not just because, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. Also true, but that it's the material conditions that underlie all of these, we can explain those, and we have to fight for those in the manners in which they are connected. So I'm gonna kind of go through some of the core insights of social reproduction theory, and some of this will be kind of piggybacking, of course, on what Rachel said. But the first insight I wanna say that helps us do that is that social gender is not monolithic across time and geography. And I think you can see how it plays out differently in all manner of societies depending on the social relations. And that's what Marxists call the material conditions, and why we call ourselves materialists, because that's what helps us understand what's going on. So Holly Lewis says the significance of gender within any given society varies depending on the mode of production, the cultural and legal infrastructure supporting the mode of production, and even the institutional histories inherited after shifts in material conditions. And that's kind of our job, is to figure out how to navigate that and understand what's going on. And that's why you can see why, you know, pre-class societies might have, you know, gender might look really different, or it might look really different in a country with a massive social safety net, as opposed to in a country, you know, where they're really pushing through neoliberalism. So as a sub-point to that, the existence of social gender itself does not actually mean that gender is the oppressor. So just because a society acknowledges or, you know, recognizes gender as a distinction among people, or even if the division of labor appears to take on a gendered form, that by itself isn't the problem. What is? It's the existence of the class inequality that is meaning that you need to give special meaning to this category. And that is where that's because of class society and because of the private property, which Rachel laid out really beautifully. So how do we apply that to, you know, the advanced capitalism in which we find ourselves, unfortunately? Well, our, you know, particular society is organized in a particular kind of way. We're going to talk about that in terms of economics. So Holly Lewis again, economics is the origin of normativity in heteronormativity. Not intolerance of difference of the other, not a pure desire for power or an abstract need for control, not a lack of sexual creativity or dullness, not a Eurocentric racial spirit. It is the fact that the generational replacement of the labor force requires and I'm going to quibble with her verbiage in a second, requires sexually active people with certain body parts to go through extended periods of non-activity. I'll quibble with her first, and then I'll talk about what I mean. I quibble over sexually active people. That's not the only way people become pregnant. We know that through violence and through turkey basters and through IVF and so on. There's lots of different ways that people get knocked up. But the point is that very act of having to be pregnant and then leaving the workplace at these very inconvenient times during your peak years of the ability to extract surplus labor removes people from the workplace and not into non-activity. What she means by non-activity is non-creation of surplus value. We could tell you as parents, and I'm sure everybody here, that your time is not active. But the point is that this is the capital, I'm going to read again, the capitalist class benefits from this generational replacement, but it does not want to make concessions to the people who make it happen. Social gender and the management of sexuality under capitalism are then shaped according to the struggle over who pays for what is necessary to socially reproduce the working class. And then that is where ideology comes in, because you then have to create a justification for why you're not going to value this thing that we all know is necessary, right? We have to socially reproduce ourselves somehow. People got to get to work, we got to have new generations of people and so forth. But it saves the capitalist class a lot of money. As we know, it's valued in the billions of dollars, all of the, you know, unpaid labor that folks do for social reproduction, as well as, you know, the ways that social reproductive work in the public sphere is devalued, right? Because we know that feminized labor is always underpaid. So the way that they do this is they woman us. So I think, I like to say, we didn't cross gender, gender crossed us. So I think, you know, we get into this question of like, well, what is the thing that brings all these people together? Like, we know that there's a common interest, but why? And I really like how she puts this. These normative categories of, I'll start here. A normative ethos is created to regulate the sexuality of those who produce children for the ruling class, a category called woman, which is normative. Another category, also bearing the title woman, has a separate normative ethos that regulates the sexuality of working class women. So we know that not all women are expected to do the exact same things depending on class. However, these normative categories are not empirical categories populated by actual ontological beings called women. These categories are filled with all sorts of people. Many of them are in this room. Heterosexual, cisgendered women, lesbians, bisexual, genderqueers, gay trans men, people who consider themselves to be third sexes or agender, intersex people, surrogates for wealthy gay men, colonized people, and people living in imperialist nations. Genderqueer, two-spirit, third sex people, and trans men are emerging political subjects who have been forced into these categories. So we've all been kind of feminized by our relation to production. That's the thing that we have in common. And the reason for that is that we all play this really essential role in both the reproduction of humans and the reproduction of social life, right? Therefore, you need an ideology that we would call sexism, which would devalue all of that. That has to exist alongside a justification for why we would still say that this class of people who can get pregnant is so different from this other class of people that behaves themselves and doesn't get pregnant and does their, you know, masculine duty of going out and doing the productive labor, so-called. The goal of capitalist ideology around gender then is to naturalize this whole thing. So reading again, in capitalistically developed societies, strict sexual dimorphism, that is an idea that there are two different biological sexes, is promoted as the foundation of all that counts for natural. However, behind the scenes, sexual dimorphism is actually manufactured and maintained through surgical interventions on intersex children, through the production of commodities aimed at normalizing and shaping secondary sex characteristics such as leg wax, eyebrow tweezers, cosmetics, bodybuilding supplements, and so on. So there's not anything really all that natural about this. I'm going to throw something out that perhaps we are all cyborg after all. This is sort of the foundation for oppositional sexism, at any rate. Um, so So I think the point of this then is that we do have a pretty profound basis for solidarity, and that's clearly why people are here, is to figure out how to put that into practice. And of course, it's easier said than done, but that is our task as social reproduction feminists, is to get out there and do that. This is critical, right? We can't hope to win without this kind of solidarity. And Holly says, solidarity between working class people in the category called women, or anybody who is feminized, including the men lumped into it, is critical for the fight for all people's bodily freedom. So the way that we can do this is through politics, and I think I mentioned this earlier. I think what gets frustrating is a lot of this gets parsed out in the linguistic sphere, like, oh, you used the wrong word about this, or, oh, you know, a moral sort of imperative to kind of call people in. Those aren't wrong questions to have, but I think what we need is actually to be in practice pulling this out. So for us, we have to kind of go back to say it's the capitalist relations of production that demand the maintenance of the gender binary. And our job is to actually increase the value of what we do that's socially reproductive labor and undermine in everything we do the lie of the gender binary and of the ways that they are undermining the value of socially reproductive labor. And I think it's really through that lens that we're able to draw the connections to saying, you know, why issues like the epidemic of murder against Black trans women is absolutely connected to the project also of climate justice, to abolishing borders, to all of these kinds of things. I work in, I'm a midwife, and so I think a lot about maternal and gestational parent mortality and all these kinds of spheres. These are all so very connected to the questions of who's controlling the means of production and of reproduction and our right to express ourselves within that freely. So I think I'll turn it back to Rachel for now.
So just to say a little bit more about what this fight over control of physical reproduction looks like right at the moment, I mentioned before that we're seeing this surge of anti-abortion legislation that is not, we want to argue, not merely a matter of controlling women's bodies. I think that's kind of the main language that's been used in opposition to it, but that it's also about a fight to reassert a certain gendered order rooted in the nuclear family. I'm hoping that we can all chime in about like what social reproduction looks like under neoliberalism, so I'm not going to go on about it too much, but I think it is really important to put this assault in the context of the way that our conditions of life are being reorganized under neoliberalism as well. And it comes back to that contradiction that I was talking about before, that I think is so central to capitalism, and potentially central to its challenge, is that to the extent that wages are driven down, workers have to expend more of ourselves on paid work, and that means we have less left over for all of the unpaid work to sustain ourselves. The current norm of multiple income earners in each household means that we have come to rely more on commercial goods and services in place of some of the work we used to do for free at home. That's fine, maybe, if you can afford it, but Nancy Fraser makes the point in the same book, Social Reproduction Theory, that wages have fallen behind the socially necessary costs of production, of reproduction, sorry. So our workplaces expect us to be highly educated, always available via smartphone, personally responsible for maintaining our own wellness so that we don't get gouged by rising insurance costs, but at the same time, we can barely afford rent, especially in coastal cities. We make up that difference in some ways by debt, in other cases by moving back in with relatives. As a whole, we're, I think, much more reliant on some of our very gendered relationships in the context of this squeeze. And the ruling class isn't just ignoring that we're having a harder time getting by when they go on the offensive around our ability to control our family size. I think they're actually responding to the fact that we're struggling more to get by because they want us to turn our exasperation inward. They want us to be struggling harder to make our own lives work so that we're not organizing together or, say, leading a wildcat teacher strike. This month, new restrictions are going into effect in Arkansas, Idaho, Indiana, Ohio, South Dakota, and Tennessee. According to Rewire News, in the past 6 months, legislators have introduced nearly 400 anti-choice measures in states across the country. 26 of them have passed. They include these so-called fetal heartbeat bills, which are a complete misnomer. They criminalize abortion once an ultrasound can detect electrical activities in embryos that actually don't have hearts yet, as early as 6 weeks. Now, the surge of anti-abortion legislation is openly targeting Roe. They want to pass unconstitutional measures to get it in front of Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court. But I think that they're also really working to reassert a gender binary in which women are only cis women who, either repress their sexuality or submit to involuntary parenthood. Trans men in this situation and gender non-conforming people are forced into this bind as well. An even greater conflict with their actual gender identities and expressions. And trans women are basically further demonized by this set of gender norms. So it's not a coincidence that at the same time we're seeing the Republicans go on a warpath around trans women's rights and bathroom access. It's really two parts of the same project of trying to redefine gender. And I think they really need us to be locked in contention within our families. They really fear the rise of a feminist movement that's led by trans people, that fights for the full breadth of reproductive justice, that recognizes that Black and brown people's reproduction has been limited and criminalized in specific ways. And so that's exactly what we need to build. Historically, fights over social reproduction haven't always taken place at the point of production, so they don't necessarily always shut down capitalist ability to accumulate profits. But capitalism's squeeze on social reproduction does always compel social struggles, and those can be incredibly powerful in moving and uniting sections of the working class that can otherwise be divided against one another or just locked in despair.
So now we get to the fun stuff, because all of this can be kind of a little depressing. But I just want to say, like, in conclusion, there's nothing natural about what society calls gender. Although sure, there's stuff we can debate about. That's a whole other topic. So we want to talk about abolition. What do we want to abolish? So Rachel already mentioned we'd like to abolish the family. What that means is that we want to get rid of the compulsion to organize ourselves along these privatized lines that isolate us into these little places where there's no kind of social accountability and where we don't necessarily have a whole lot of choices about how we live day to day. So the way that we can get at that is actually by getting rid of capitalism. So that's our small goal. By being able to like organize society around common human need, socializing the productive capacities of our society so that we can have food and housing and blah 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 blah, childcare, etc. No, childcare is the other part, right? Is the social reproduction part. So then we're going to reorganize the way that we configure our daily lives based on a whole other thing. So we see seeds of this in so many different beautiful places. And I think that queer social reproduction is a beautiful example of this. And what I mean by that is basically the way that queer folks have organized ourselves across generations for survival. Many folks are probably now like watching the beautiful TV series Pose, where you see the ballroom scene in New York in the 80s, and you see a trans woman, a mother, having this house where she's taking care of the next generation of basically like kids that were kicked out of their houses, who are homeless, who are on the street economy, etc. That's beautiful, but it's about survival under pretty difficult circumstances and pretty dark stuff going on. Now imagine if we could reorganize ourselves, like that, but without all the other disease and stuff that we don't need to that we can eliminate in many ways, right, under socialism. So that's one example. I was at the sex worker panel yesterday, and somebody was talking about similar sort of ways of that sex workers had organized and for their own survival, right? This social reproduction that happens in these kind of queer ways happens everywhere. Sophie Lewis has a beautiful example about black motherhood that I don't have time to read. The work that folks are doing around mutual aid for trans asylum seekers, that folks should go to that meetup tonight over dinner. All of these are different examples of queer social reproduction. And I like that because it's a little seed. It's not by itself revolutionary, but it's the only way that queers have survived. So like, if we're gonna have like queer socialist future, we gotta survive. So, you know, that's not an end in itself, but it's necessary for our own ability to make revolution. So then the question is, what kind of revolutionary change are we talking about? We could keep talking about, right, abolishing the family, all this kind of stuff. So two different things. One is, I think Rachel already outlined really beautifully what it means to take these politics into the world. So there's the sort of revolutionary action in the here and now of movement building, you know, networks of social reproduction feminists out there in the urgent struggles of today. I didn't even mention healthcare, gosh, Medicare for all, et cetera. But in the second sense, when we're talking about revolution, we're really talking about connecting the issues of gender justice as integral to economic and social justice that can only be won through dismantling capitalism. So I'm going to end with this gorgeous quote from Sophie Lewis's new book, which I encourage folks to read, about surrogacy. She says, let's bring about the conditions for the possibility of open source, fully collaborative gestation. And I think this is a foundation because I'm a midwife, so I always think about like gestation as the beginning of things. Let's prefigure a way of manufacturing one another non-competitively. Let's hold one another hospitably, explode notions of hereditary parentage, and multiply real, loving solidarities. Let us build a care commune based on comradeship, a world sustained by kith and kind more than by kin. Where pregnancy is concerned, let every pregnancy be for everyone. Let us overthrow, in short, the family.